This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 10. Those dangerous, subversive Asian values. So here we are, episode 10. We covered the first 100 years of Singapore from its founding to about 1900 in two episodes. And now we've covered the next 30 years of Singapore from around 1900 to 1930 in six episodes. In these six episodes, we covered all the various events which shaped Singapore throughout the first 30 years. In episode 5, we talked about how rich Singapore was, but also how aloof the European and local elites were from the rest of the people. In the past 4 episodes, we've specifically covered the same 2 decades from 3 different perspectives: the Islamic community, the Chinese community, and the workers. And we brought this all together with 2 leading responses to these conflicts: the Chinese and Indonesian left, and the Malay left. Last week, I spoke about the history of Malaya as moving through a continuous period where the 1920s are the birth of left-wing movements in Malaya. The 1930s, a period where the British colonial authorities ruthlessly suppressed and destroyed many of these movements. The early 1940s is a time when the Japanese then in turn ruthlessly dispatched the British, thus giving the previous left-wing movements time and space to revive and re-establish themselves. And the late 1940s, as a time when the left-wing movements grew into coherent and organized movements. So today, we talk about the British response to all these upheavals that were sweeping Singapore and the world, and how they ruthlessly suppressed and destroyed many of these movements, and what happened after. And in particular, how the events of the 1930s sets the stage for what happens after the war, because the pattern of events from before the war repeat themselves afterwards. Remember, there are essential continuities from the things that happen in the 20s and 30s that then, once they are given space to revive and re-establish themselves, resurface in the 50s and 60s. So, to recap what's happened, we have increasing colonial demands for self-determination, for justice, for equality. We have demands for a government that genuinely takes into account the needs and aspirations of its people. How did the British respond? Why, by crushing the life out of these demands, of course. From their perspective, all this desire for democracy and self-determination, it's seditious, it's dangerous. All these Asian values of freedom and democracy and justice and equality coming out of China and India and Indonesia, no, what this colony, this British colony needs are good colonial values, harmony, a need for a single party, a single benevolent authoritarian government which can take the long view, which can focus on socio-economic prosperity and collective well-being of the colony, an emphasis on loyalty and respect towards authority, because economic development and long-term stability are more important than civil and political rights. We need to think about the good of the colony over the individual. These are the real proper colonial values which are best for this colony, and so for your own good, we have to crush these new dangerous, foreign, seditious Asian values of freedom and justice, because we care. We are a government that cares about you, about our subject peoples. And when push comes to shove, we will kill your friends and family to remind you of our love. And so, as revolutionary nationalism arose throughout Asia, the colonial government responded by spying on its subjects, introducing tough new regulations, and intervening into the lives of its people to an unprecedented degree. World War I is when the modern security state was created in Singapore as a tool of colonial oppression. After 1916, the British began to gather systematic intelligence. They spied on all the groups we've talked about in previous episodes: returning Malay Hajis and graduates of Al-Azhar, globe-trotting Arab traders, Indonesian traders and political exiles, Chinese activists, traders and teachers, and even Japanese businessmen and European writers and thinkers. And in 1919, All of this was brought together into a single new organization whose purpose was to deal with all political opposition to colonial rule. It was called Special Branch. Or as I like to call them, the Special Executive for Colonialism, Torture, Repression and Exile, or SPECTRE. Sadly, 100 years later, it is still here and as strong as ever, and today it's called the Internal Security Department. To enable this repression, the colonial government passed laws. Oh boy, did they pass laws. The Sedition Act, the Banishment Ordinance, the Registration of School Ordinance 1920, which aimed to, and I quote, prevent the teaching of undesirable political doctrines, unquote, by closing schools which did not comply with its regulations, which ostensibly applied to all schools but was, quote, most necessary in the case of Chinese vernacular schools, unquote. And, of course, the Immigration Restriction Ordinance, which severely restricted Chinese immigration. And they amended all these laws again and again and again as necessary. All these acts were amended repeatedly, along with the Registration of Societies Act and other repressive legislation. The Immigration Ordinance was replaced by an Aliens Ordinance, which the Secretary for Chinese Affairs admitted was partly designed to check political dissidents. And this had dramatic results. Male immigration from China fell from 158,000 in 1930 to less than 14,000 in 1933. The Registration of Schools Ordinance and its repeated amendments caused Victor Purcell, then Inspector of Chinese Schools, to describe his job as, quote, in essence, police work, entailing interference with the liberty of the subject to teach what he liked, read what he liked, and to learn what he liked, unquote. The laws were openly discriminatory. The Banishment Ordinance, for example, differentiated between expulsion, in which someone is quietly asked to leave the colony by a certain time, and banishment, in which a person is arrested and held like a criminal until they can be put on a ship to go back to wherever they were born. The polite expulsion, of course, was used mainly against white Europeans, whereas banishment was used against those devious Asians, especially the Indonesians and the Chinese. If you were a left-wing Chinese, banished back to South China where the right-wing Kuomintang ruled, then banishment was a virtual death sentence. The apogee, the peak of this trend, came under Governor Sir Cecil Clementi, who arrived to take control of Singapore in 1929. On paper, the appointment looked ideal. Clementi was proficient in Cantonese and Mandarin and had long experience working with the Chinese. He had begun his colonial service in 1899 as a cadet in Hong Kong, where he rose to be colonial secretary. And after serving in British Guiana and Ceylon, returned to Hong Kong as governor in 1925. With an outstanding reputation as an administrator and an expert on China, he was welcomed in Singapore at a critical time when Malay was facing the brunt of the Great Depression. But the cold, intellectual Clementi was an abrupt change from his predecessor, local boy and military man, Hugh Clifford. Clementi alienated local leaders and his staff were very uncomfortable in his presence, his superior presence. Clementi's period as governor in Hong Kong had been turbulent because China's troubles had spilled over into the colony. And he arrived in Singapore with a deep distrust of the Kuomintang and a firm conviction that firm measures were needed to control sedition. And so Clementi, to suppress what he strongly perceived as chiefly Chinese problem, took stringent measures against the Chinese. He passed many strong measures to counteract what he saw as subversion and deal with economic distress. But these were racially divisive and roused widespread opposition. He censored the Chinese press, increased surveillance on Chinese schools and closed many of them, and banned books and textbooks. The Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce, as leaders of the local Chinese community, strongly opposed many of these bills, and the Singapore Chinese Chamber of Commerce submitted official protests, but the colonial government was not dissuaded. To placate Chinese unhappiness, the government promised that the Registration of Schools Bill would be used to improve Chinese schools. A system of grants in aid for Chinese schools was introduced in 1923. However, these promises were not kept. Measures for the training of teachers, compilation of textbooks, or improvements in curriculum were, quote, half-heartedly undertaken and usually after long procrastination, unquote. Nor were they fair. In 1929, Chinese schools in the Federated Malay States received $9.78 per pupil in aid, whereas an aided English school received $54 in aid per pupil, and a government English school received $87.50 per pupil in aid. Worse, the grants in aid were used as a lever to threaten the Chinese schools. Misbehave? Well, we'll withdraw these grants which you now need to run the schools. Clementi wanted to create a common Malayan identity among all Malayan youth. Okay, that seems sensible. But he chose to do this by trying to change all Chinese and Indians into Malays, by forcing all Chinese and Indians to accept Malay language education. Discrimination against Chinese and Tamil schools was stepped up and grants in aid frozen in 1932. To discourage switching to English education, fees for English schools were increased. Likewise for workers, Clementi crushed the incipient labour movement. This, of course, was not new. Previous governors had cracked down on the labour movement due to its close association with the left-wing revolutionary Kuomintang. Remember, the Kuomintang was chiefly a left-wing revolutionary party in Malaya until 1927, and even after that, continued to have a significant left-wing element. As I mentioned in the previous episode, due to ruthless police attacks, a lack of leadership, financial difficulties, the communists were never able to exercise significant influence. In 1930, a year into Clementi's reign, they attempted to reorganize and created the new Malayan Communist Party. But again, the party never quite managed to get off the ground as its leaders and members were repeatedly arrested and banished. Until finally, in 1935, the British double agent Loy Tak was appointed as its leader. But these measures suppressed all labor activism alike, whether or not they were motivated by genuine grievances or discrimination, or whether they were actually politically motivated. And so by the time Clementi's governorship ended in 1934, the colony was firmly in the grip of recession and repression, the spirit and vitality of the local nationalist movement crushed by the British. And worse, his policies had systematically alienated the Chinese population of Singapore, who were convinced he was a racist. The genial Tan Cheng Lock was so angered by Clementi that at one point he stormed out of a legislative council meeting. At another point, during the passage of the Aliens Bill, he said, and I quote, "The government has no fixed and constructive policy to win over the Straits and other Malayan-born Chinese, who are subjects of this country, and to foster and strengthen their spirit of patriotism and natural love for the country of their birth and adoption." One is driven to the conclusion that the bill is part and parcel of an anti-Chinese policy, probably with a political objective based on distrust and fear, which the Chinese, on the whole, as a community, have done nothing and have given absolutely no cause to merit. Unquote. So the Chinese accuse Clementi of racism, and over two decades later, into the 50s, the Chinese continued to recall Clementi's action as a major example of colonial discrimination. His lasting legacy among the Chinese community was to make the Chinese forever regard the colonial government with suspicion, especially in educational and cultural affairs. By 1932, his systemic discrimination against the Chinese, especially in education and labour policy, had spawned alienation from the colonial society and its elite, and their protests were met with legalised violence and repression. But one effect of this was that, previously divided by language, dialect, class, ancestry and job, the Chinese were now beginning to be united by this growing sense of alienation and colonial repression. There's an area of Singapore named Clementi or Clementi, but it's not named for Sir Cecil Clementi. It's actually named for his uncle, Sir Cecil Clementi Smith, who was governor from 1887 to 1893, and he was very popular among the Chinese. So those of you who live there, don't worry. You're not living in an area named for a racist. But of course, the government of Singapore were not simply racist and reactionaries. They were led by smart men who also sought to accommodate a changing world. And when we return, we'll look at one crucial reform which would have important implications for Malay. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thun. If you've just joined us, we are in the middle of this week's episode of The History of Singapore entitled Those Dangerous Subversive Asian Values. As I was saying, the government of Singapore had racist and reactionary policies, but they weren't simply led by racists and reactionaries. They were led by smart men who also sought to accommodate a changing world, as long as it was on British terms, of course. And I want to highlight one reform movement in particular, which would anticipate the fierce battles over merger 20 years later. Over the first three decades of the 20th century, there were attempts by the governors to draw together the administration of all the Malayan states into a closer, more unified, more rational arrangement rather than this big hodgepodge that existed. This was started by Governor John Anderson in 1909. Another attempt was made by Governor Sir Lawrence Gulmart in 1925 and carried on by Sir Cecil Clementi in 1931. But the discussions always founded on three main points. First, the economic, political, demographic and strategic dominance of Singapore meant that it would dominate any proposed arrangement. The Malay rulers were wary of any threat to their power and dominance, and the British agreed. Sir Samuel Wilson, permanent Undersecretary of State for the Colonies, was sent out to Malaya to study this problem. And in his report published in 1933, he wrote that, quote, "The maintenance of the position, authority and prestige of the Malay rulers must always be a cardinal point in British policy. And the encouragement of indirect rule will probably prove the greatest safeguard against the political submersion of the Malays, which would result from the development of popular government on Western lines." Second, the Chinese were afraid that, as a minority, their interests would be threatened in a united Malaya, especially in later years given the racist policies of Clementi. They could barely protect themselves in the Straits settlements which they numerically dominated. In a united Malaya, where they'd be a minority, things could very well be worse for them. Third, the different economies of the different states made closer unity difficult. Businessmen north of the causeway balked at being subjected to Singapore, while their Singapore counterparts dreaded the prospect of a Malayan common market with external tariffs, which would damage Singapore's treasured free trade entrepôt status. Clementi appointed a committee to study this problem, which concluded that a customs union was, quote, "essentially opposed to the interests of the colony and undesirable in any circumstances that can be foreseen," unquote. And these are the same three points which, 30 years later, merger and Malaysia would founder on. And so instead, in 1935, Wilson's compromise was adopted, which made administration in the states more uniform and created a few new pan-Malayan departments. But many powers were devolved to the states, with Singapore-based department directors acting as advisors. This was a messy compromise that assuaged regional and sectional fears at the expense of leaving Malaya divided and disorganized, and would make eventual reunification much harder. So, to come back to my main point, the British quite ruthlessly repressed local nationalism and demands for justice and representative government, but without ever really understanding their subjects. The great Rupert Emerson, professor of political science at Harvard, observed this when he came to study Malaya in the 1930s. In 1937, he produced the seminal work Malaya, A Study in Direct and Indirect Rule. In it, he wrote, quote, "The government of the colony is run by a small group of insiders living a life, the comfort and luxuries of which are rarely impaired by too close contact with the sordid poverty which has set its stamp on the great bulk of the population. It is still no exaggeration to say that it is a government run by and for those who have won through to power and wealth, and devil take the hindermost." He concluded that, quote, "Imperialism appears to be committed to perpetuating its own rule, and that it is challenged by a force which makes it necessary or expedient for it to withdraw," unquote. And that's the government of Singapore for you. Rich, aloof, convinced of their benevolent paternalism, committed first and foremost to maintaining their long-term rule against the changes that were roiling the world, Asia, Malaya, Singapore, against these new, dangerous, subversive Asian values of freedom and justice and representative government. But a force was coming that would make it necessary for it to withdraw. Within a few years, the British colonial government, the Chinese capitalist elites, and the anti-colonial Malayan Communist Party would join hands into the most unlikely of alliances, an alliance which would also later prove formative to Singapore's independence movement. What crazy enemy could force these three most bitter enemies to become unlikely bedfellows? Why, the Japanese, of course. As As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthang. See you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.